Welcome to the Deep Dive. We take all your sources and really pull out those golden nuggets. Today we're going deep into Vina Van Camp. A story of love, betrayal, and a whole lot of money, which really shaped California law and, you know, still matters a lot, especially for entrepreneurs. Picture this. Building a seafood empire from scratch, only to have all the profits become this battleground in a nasty divorce.
Yeah. This case is so interesting because of how it handles extreme cruelty in a marriage and how to split up assets when there's a booming business involved. It's like succession meets law school.
We've got court documents to look at, legal analysis, and historical context.
Our mission.
Helping you guys understand the key takeaways of this case and how it affects businesses today.
And there are some wild details. Did Frank Van Camp actually cheat? How much did his wife end up getting? And most importantly, how does this case affect your business today?
All right, let's set the scene. California. The roaring 20s. We've got Frank Van Camp, a successful businessman in his 50s. He built his Van Camp Seafood Company way before meeting his wife. Enter a much younger woman, only 21 when they got married in 1916. What an age gap, right?
And importantly, Frank had a lot of assets going into the marriage, including that very successful seafood company. This becomes a really big issue later.
A few years into the marriage, things go bad. The wife files for divorce, claiming Frank was having an affair with a coworker. We're talking public dates and even a suspicious drive to a secluded wooded area.
Now, the court didn't find enough proof of adultery, but these accusations, along with claims of neglect and verbal abuse, they paint a picture of a pretty troubled relationship. There's even mention of at least one physical assault. And this is where things get really interesting legally.
Because this is where extreme cruelty comes in, right?
Yeah.
The court had to figure out if Frank's actions fit the legal definition. But in 1920s California, proving extreme cruelty wasn't as easy as showing some bruises.
Exactly. California law at the time recognized acts causing great physical suffering or mental torture. A key point for anyone dealing with family law today is that the victim's sensitivity is considered. This case helped establish that cruelty doesn't have a one-size-fits-all definition.
So even back then, emotional distress alone could be enough for a divorce. That's a huge shift from needing proof of physical violence.
It was. The court's language is pretty powerful. They use the phrase delicacy of sentiment of the complaining party, recognizing that emotional pain can be just as bad as physical harm, especially coming from someone you're supposed to trust.
Okay, so the wife wins the divorce based on extreme cruelty. But that's only half the battle. Now they have to split their assets. And Frank's booming business becomes the main problem.
The trial court initially found about $90,000 in community property and gave 2/3 of it to the wife, maybe because of the abuse claims. But then the appeals court stepped in and was like, hold on.
Yeah, they didn't agree with how the community property was valued and divided. They sent the case back for a new trial. And this decision was huge because it led to what we call the Van Camp method for handling businesses in divorce cases.
And this method is still really relevant today. To get what it means, imagine this. You start a tech company before you get married. Then, during the marriage, your company explodes in value. Does your spouse automatically get half of that success just because you were married when it happened?
That's a question that keeps entrepreneurs up at night. And Van Camp tries to answer it.
The Van Camp method says that the community, meaning the married couple, is entitled to a reasonable salary for the working spouse's labor during the marriage, but any extra profit tied to the original investment, that initial capital, remains separate property.
So in Frank's case, his company existed before his marriage. He was already making a good salary, more than enough to cover their expenses.
Mm-hmm.
The court decided that any extra profit came directly from his initial capital and his business skills, not his wife's work during their fairly short marriage.
That's it. They made a clear line between separate and community property. Frank's premarital business and its value were considered separate. His work during the marriage was a contribution to the community, but the court wanted to protect his initial investment, like two buckets, one for what you bring into the marriage and one for what you accumulate together. They wanted to treat both fairly.
So the courts are always trying to find that balance between protecting investments and recognizing both spouses' contributions. This case really shows the challenges courts have when they try to separate a business from a marriage.
It's a balancing act, and it's even harder with things like tech startups where the value can skyrocket so fast.
And that brings up another thought. What if Frank had underpaid himself during the marriage? Would the community have gotten more?
Excellent point. It shows some of the nuances of the Van Camp method. We'll dig into those more in the next part of our deep dive.
Back again for more on Van Camp v. Van Camp. We're looking at how a 1920s divorce is still affecting family law and businesses today. Last time, we talked about extreme cruelty and how the court tackled dividing assets from a booming business. This case is so important, there's another big takeaway.
Right. Van Camp gave us one way to figure out community property. But California courts have another tool, too, the Pereira method. And it can sometimes go against Van Camp.
Like Coke versus Pepsi. Two approaches to the same problem, and choosing the right one can really change the outcome of a divorce with a business involved.
Great analogy. So Van Camp is about protecting the separate property's growth and paying the spouse fairly for their work during the marriage. Pereira, though, it's different. It comes from Pereira v. Pereira, and it's usually preferred when a business's value increases, mostly because of the spouse who was actively managing it during the marriage.
So if Van Camp is about that initial investment, Pereira focuses on all the work put into the business during the marriage.
Exactly. Say someone inherits a small, kind of dead family business. Their partner comes in, uses their business smarts and hard work, and turns it into this big success.
So with Pereira, the spouse who made the business grow would probably get a bigger share of that increased value. Seems way fairer when one person really made the business successful.
That's the idea. Pereira tries to figure out how much of the growth is because of the spouse's work during a marriage and calls that community property. It's recognizing the value of their contribution.
Separating out each spouse's contribution sounds hard. How do you measure one spouse's work against the starting value of the business?
It can get really complicated. That's why these cases often involve expert testimony from financial analysts and people who value businesses. They break down all the things that made the business successful and put a price tag on each part.
Like untangling a really messy knot. You have to carefully pull apart the threads to see how they're connected and what each one did to the final knot.
Perfect way to picture it. Just like with any knot, there's no one perfect way to untangle it. Courts have to look at each case individually, consider all the circumstances, and then decide whether Van Camp or Pereira will be fairer.
I bet there are times when either method could work, depending on how you see the facts and evidence. Must be interesting for the lawyers in these cases.
Definitely. It leaves room for debate, different interpretations, and for lawyers to come up with creative arguments. Van Camp and Pereira give a framework, but applying them really depends on the specifics of each case.
Aspiring family lawyers, take note. Van Camp and Pereira are essential tools for your community property work. These cases aren't just old legal history, they're still being debated and used in courtrooms every day.
Totally agree. Understanding both methods is crucial for representing clients well in divorce cases when there's a business involved. This leads to an interesting question that connects this old case to how business is done today.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. What about the digital age, with online businesses working from home and the lines between work and personal life getting blurry? Imagine a business that's completely online. How do you even begin to separate separate and community property?
Great question, and it shows how a case from almost 100 years ago is still important in our changing world. We see new challenges and legal questions that the people who created Van Camp and Pereira probably never imagined.
Seems like these methods might need updating to keep up with the times, right?
Definitely worth discussing. Maybe we'll see future case law that clarifies how to use these methods for modern businesses. But for now, lawyers and judges have to grapple with these questions and try to find solutions that are fair and balanced.
We've covered a lot on property division, but let's not forget about extreme cruelty from the Van Camp case. It really changed how emotional abuse is seen as a reason for divorce. We'll come back to that in the last part of our deep dive. All right, welcome back to the deep dive. We're wrapping up our look at Van Camp v. Van Camp. We've covered the Van Camp and Pereira methods for dividing up property when a business is involved. But before we finish, let's circle back to extreme cruelty. This case wasn't just about business assets and divorce.
Yeah, exactly. It also really solidified the idea that emotional abuse can be just as bad as physical abuse, and it can be a reason for divorce.
We talked about how Van Camp acknowledged that emotional suffering could justify a divorce, even way back then. But how has the legal understanding of extreme cruelty changed since that ruling?
Well, societal norms have definitely changed since the 1920s. Divorce was a much bigger deal back then, and the idea that you could end a marriage because of emotional abuse, that was just starting to become accepted.
It's interesting how legal stuff often takes a while to catch up with social change, right? As we've learned more about domestic violence and psychological abuse, the legal system has started to recognize these issues more.
For sure. Today, courts are much more likely to consider a wider range of behaviors as extreme cruelty.
Like, what kinds of behaviors? It's not just about physical violence anymore, is it?
Nope, not at all. Now, courts look at things like constant verbal abuse, controlling behavior, intimidation, isolating someone from their friends and family, even financial manipulation. All of that can be considered when deciding if there's been extreme cruelty.
That's a much broader definition than what we saw in Van Camp. It recognizes that emotional abuse can be really sneaky and subtle.
Absolutely. It's not always yelling and fighting. It can be this slow thing that wears down a person's self-esteem. It can take away their sense of self over time.
And that's why it's so important for the legal system to keep up with our understanding of these issues. If the law doesn't recognize how damaging emotional abuse can be, victims might not get help or even realize they're victims.
Exactly. If we don't address emotional abuse, it's like saying it's okay in a relationship, which it's absolutely not.
While Van Camp was groundbreaking for its time, it's important to see how far we've come in understanding abuse in relationships. Courts have better tools and a more nuanced view now.
It's definitely progress. The legal system is better at protecting victims and holding abusers accountable. But there's always more to do. More awareness to raise. More support to provide.
Yeah, it's a reminder that as society changes, so does our understanding of extreme cruelty. The law has to adapt, too.
Well said. Legal precedents aren't just words. They're living ideas that shape how we see justice and fairness. And as we face new challenges and our values change, those ideas need to adapt as well.
As we wrap up this deep dive into Van Camp v. Van Camp, I'm really struck by how impactful this one case has been. It's 100 years old, but the stuff it brought up, community property, business valuation, abuse in marriage, it's all still so relevant today.
It's a case that keeps people talking, shapes legal strategies, and reminds us that justice is an ongoing process, not a finish line.
Van Camp really shows us that the law is always changing to reflect how we understand relationships, business, and what it means to be fair and just within the legal system.
Perfectly put. And on that note, we hope you'll keep digging into the details of this case and how it applies to today's world. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive, everyone. We'll be back soon with another fascinating case to explore. Until then, keep learning, keep asking questions, and keep diving deep.